Hey, everybody. Thanks for listening to Shop Talk Show this week. We have two awesome sponsors. One is Converge SE, ConvergeSE.com. It's a conference in Columbia, South Carolina, April 25th through 27th. I'll be there. It's going to be awesome, about web everything. We'll tell you a little bit more about that later in the show. And our longtime sponsor, Environments for Humans, who have an upcoming conference, April 16th through 18th, all about responsive web design. You can attend it from anywhere in the world because it's an online conference. Check it out at rwdsummit.com. But for now, let's kick things off.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to episode 61 of the Shop Talk Show, a podcast all about sound effects and front-end web design and development. And I'm Dave Rupert, and I have here with me Chris Coyer.
Hi, everybody. And our guest this week is Alex Sexton. Hey, thanks for joining us, Alex.
No problem.
Alex, thanks so much for coming on.
No sweat. Should be a good time. Already two sound effects.
You live in Austin, right? You both live
Austin,
in
Austin, Texas.
Yeah, cool.
Alex, how about you tell us a little bit about what you do? What's your day job? And then we'll jump into maybe some of your
I don't even know the accomplishments, answer to this.
Storied know. Accomplishments.
My day job. I work at a place called Bizarre Voice. We do our biggest products is ratings and reviews. So we're kind of like Discuss for e-commerce, if you want to use one of those fun things where you say you're like this for that. Mm-hmm. But we're really big. We're like a public company. We're on Walmart and Dell and Samsung and Best Buy and stuff. But you won't know because we're white label. So I write that third-party JavaScript application that runs on other people's websites.
Awesome.
Yeah, so you have some things to say about third-party JavaScript and speed and stuff.
Cool. And Alex, you have contributed to just a couple libraries out there that people might know. One being Modernizer. Am I saying that correctly?
I've never heard of it.
Modernizer. Yeah. And Yep Nope. Which is like a what would you call it? A Boolean script loader? Is that
A conditional script loader.
Conditional script loader. And then you help run a conference called TXJS, which is about JavaScript.
Yeah, I did.
And you used to host the ever like epic, the most epic podcast, video podcast there's ever been in the history of the internet, YayQuery. And I wish I had the YayQuery sound effect. I totally dropped the ball. I'm going to go find it.
Okay.
YayQuery.
You'll be back in a minute. So YepNope is kind of baked into Modernizer, right? I don't know if I just want to cover this briefly. YepNope is kind of like if something turns out to be true, then load this resource, be it CSS or JavaScript or whatever. And if it turns out to be false, then load something else. Yeah, that's the gist of it.
That's it.
And you need some true false. You need to run a true false test somehow. So like, what better to return true or false than Modernizer, which is like that's its whole job.
Modernizer is really good at true and false.
Right. But do people use? Is there a lot of usage of YepNope? I mean, I guess I don't know how you would know this, but maybe you do just because you're the author of it. Do people use it standalone quite a bit and like bring their own true false?
Oh yeah. YepNope is probably one of the banes of my existence because people use it so poorly. The average user of YepNope is not using it correctly. So people generally like they might have one true or false in there, and then they'll have like 26 separate async script includes. It's essentially people are using it as like
a packager.
Something like that. And a lot of times the true falses will be like. Like if this class exists on my page, like load jQuery and then use jQuery to do like a find class. And if the length of this find class is higher than one or whatever, then load in the thing that makes the accordion carousel move. Yeah. So I'm trying to write 2.0 in a way that's essentially worse, but to make it more, I mean, you can still do that. So I'm not blocking you from doing that stuff, but it's going to be a lot harder to do it and load in 26 files. So I'm gonna start pushing towards like builds. Essentially, you should have one or two booleans that mix together, and then a single script loads after that. It's not faster to load 26 scripts via script injection than anything, I think.
Interesting.
So what made that jQuery example so ridiculous is that just because the skill level varies on the show a bunch. Sure. jQuery has like a script loader kind of in it anyway, right? So if you ran that test and you found that there's more than one slide, so I need the carousel script, you could just use git script, and right? I mean, it's at that point.
Use if statements. I mean, Yepnope was never a replacement for just raw JavaScript. The thing that Yepnope does that makes it special versus git script is it ensures in-order loading, but asynchronous, in-order execution and asynchronous loading. So you can load 10 scripts all at the same time and then execute them in the correct order. And only very modern browsers can do that by default with a few extra properties.
Git script not being something that will help you with that in-order stuff, yeah?
Correct.
And then back to that podcast we were talking about.
Dave must have found a sound effect. There you go.
Come on! Come on, everybody! Let's go!
Am I allowed to play more than 15 seconds of it?
Yeah, I think it's all CC by SA or something.
This is the best theme song in the whole wide world. Okay, here, I'll stop it. I loved jQuery. What happened to jQuery?
Paul moved to the West Coast.
I'm Paul.
To work at Google. I don't know if you've heard of those guys. But
small company out of Mountain View, California.
Yeah. But it wasn't so much that he was working at Google, though. I'm sure they made him evil or whatever. But it was that there was a four-hour time difference, so Rebecca would be ready to go to bed, and Paul would be getting off work. So we plan on doing like two episodes, maybe live ones a year. We did one this year so far, and a surprising amount of people watched it in its 3-hour entirety when it was live, and then we never cut it down and put it on the website. So we have a strong showing so far this year.
It's good. Get all the whole season out in one go. That's a good strategy. Yeah, love that show. Obviously, you're very knowledgeable about JavaScript. So I'm gonna test your CSS chops, if you don't mind.
I'm speaking at CSS Conf. Are any of you guys?
Are you really? I can't make that one. Is that the Nicole Sullivan one? Bummer.
Sounds like a lot of fun.
So you're speaking at CSS Conf and I'm speaking at TXJS.
Correct.
Is that sold out, by the way, or not?
TXJS is not sold out. I've added quite a few more tickets than I normally did this year. So it will already be bigger than it ever was, but I saw some tickets left on the site.
Nice. Okay, right. Then everybody go to 2013.texasjavascript.com. I think
do not go to TXJS.com.
It'll take you to some old one or something.
No,
it's a less than reputable website.
Okay, go to 2013.texasjavascript.com or just texasjavascript.com redirects. So, and then make sure that you click on the logo too. I just did that for the first time. 3D alert.
It's like hidden gem. Perspective, baby.
Yeah.
It's like that Firefox 3D mode.
You should check out the source.
Viewing source.
Holy crap.
Yes!
There's so more good ASCII art than code.
Dude. There's a little bit of base 64 data URIs going on too.
Highly cacheable. Highly cacheable.
The whole website is a single request.
Yeah.
Nice. You're taking the Google approach to. If window.isie equals true, or when that sounds good.
That's for font.
Stuff. Oh, font stuff.
I think there's like a window.shitty at fonts.
I love it. I'm gonna peruse your source here. So, question. Here's a question. Before we get into this, has been a week of hot drama. So I wanted to kind of keep it easy here to begin with. So this was sent in by Mr. Y Blog on Twitter, MRWI Blog on Twitter, and he asks, "Why did the element drown?"
I remember this one.
Because it couldn't float top.
So it sank. Got it.
What'd you think, Alex?
Sorry, I wasn't paying attention. float top. I'm still confused.
You can't do that. That's the joke. And then it's hard to explain.
All right, Dave, explain the joke to everybody. I think it goes better.
So a boat has to float on the top, right? But then it can't float top. This is difficult. Okay, so. Moving on, guys.
So that's Alex. He lives in Austin. He works on Modernizer and did cool crap like Yep, Nope, runs Text.js. Yes. Let's move on to the hot drama section of it. And there is so much hot drama this week, you guys, that we might not even get to any questions. I really hope that we do, but I know how much you guys love the hot drama section, and it's so robust this week that we're just going to roll with it.
Yeah. So there's infinity hot dramas this week. Let's start it. God, where to start here?
Well, I don't know. We have an order in our gate, but you don't want to start with the. I mean, I'm happy to do it this way. It seems fine. The term for it, and maybe it's an inappropriate. Even the term is hot drama, but people are calling it Dongle Gate. So there was a conference. It's not too far from me, actually. It's like San Jose ish. PyCon. It's like the annual Python Developers Conference. Two guys were there. They were making dick jokes. A woman named Adria Richards was offended by said dick jokes, turned around, take a picture of them, posted it on Twitter. This comes to that. These two guys get fired for it. Then, you know, he posts, you know, on Hacker News and it writes this thing that's like, hey, you know, we were kind of in the wrong. Pretty sorry about that. But it's also kind of a bummer that we got fired from our job. Dude's like a dad of three. And then the internet gets really mad at her, too. She gets fired from her job. So it was like this, like, dongle joke turned into some very serious problems, very real problems for some people. So the opinions about this go from 100% in support of these two poor guys that got fired to 100% support of this poor woman who was offended to, you know, more moderate views of the thing. Is that a fair assessment of what happened?
It all the way to the extreme of she got death threats from like 4chan and stuff.
and like DDoS attacks on
her
websites.
Company. On her company's
like former company.
Her former company, yeah. It's pretty intense. I mean, I just think it's crazy. I think somebody said it today on Twitter that everyone wants to be a part of a mob, you know, and this like being in a group is just like you get like high off of just tearing somebody down anonymously, you know. I think that's maybe a problem, but it's also a problem. I don't know. There's this. It's such a sticky topic because like these dudes were just like whatever telling dumb jokes to each other and then they were overheard and then
so let's this is you know let's have Dave's and, you know let's Dave you go and like what are your like gut reactions and feelings about this because you're you know
Yeah, I mean, my thing is, like, they told a stupid joke, but, I mean, in my mind, maybe I'm desensitized completely by, like, TV or whatever, but it's, like, pretty dumb jokes. I'm pretty good at jokes, but these are pretty simple, like, low-hanging fruit jokes or whatever. And then one of them, it turns out, was not even a joke. It was, like, a compliment. The idea is forking somebody's repo is, like, the ultimate compliment, which is a bit suggestive, but it's not really, like, a...
It was made suggestive by GitHub, not by those two guys.
Yeah.
Serious forking action. That's what it says when you fork a repo, right?
Yeah. Hardcore forking action or something. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. That seems like a misunderstanding. I think I was talking to a friend who, it was at PyCon. So I have a friend who just does a lot of Python stuff. And he was saying, like, to him, the scandal was that it was resolved by, like, with a mediator, like all parties were like, yeah, that was wrong or whatever. Apologize. Thanks. Like, done. And then, like, a 900 word blog post came out, and then he got fired, and then it cycled into just insanity. So the insanity thing is, like, there's people giving her death threats and stuff like that. I think that takes it way too far. I think
most people agree.
Death threats in general.
Yeah. Like, I'm going to burn you. Like, take a moment and, like, evaluate your life choices. Why you just said that to somebody anonymously?
She certainly had the right to be offended too. You know, it's just, I think most people agree at this point that, oh my God, it's unbelievable how far this thing is. Do you have any other specific thoughts on it, Alex?
Chris Williams has a post on Google Plus. Yeah, that's their thing. That I thought was interesting as a conference organizer. This is marked in the Geek Feminism Wiki as the PyCon 2013 sexism scandal, right? Donglegate, I think, is in there too. But it's kind of unfortunate that a private, you know, conversation of two people was overheard, and then, according to the code of conduct, was handled exactly in the exact anonymous manner that it was supposed to be handled in. And PyCon used their specific algorithm that they made in order to make everything go smoothly. And they did everything that they could in order to resolve a situation between attendees. And now it's, you know, it's tarnishing the name of people attached this to PyCon. It happens to JSConf. It happens to every conference that ever existed gets lambasted for anything that happens privately at the event.
So it's unfortunate that PyCon had to suffer for it, kind of, even though they did what they should have done.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think they acted great. Like, I think their reaction to it was absolutely fantastic. Their 900-word blog post was an anonymous thing that said, hey, this thing happened, so you're aware that you need to be sensitive about these types of things, but we're not releasing any of the names or any of these, you know, like, all that was... I thought they did a great job.
And that, I think, yeah, like Python, they have, the community there has set up these really awesome bylaws, and they've set, like, they have, like, a community that's like, if there's not a woman speaker, like, this is not a sanctioned, this is not a sanctioned Python event and stuff like that. Like, they have these, like, really inclusive, like, guidelines, and yeah, and it just, like, even that community that is so healthy in that manner is now just got ripped apart by that. That's unfortunate.
Well, next year we'll tell, I guess. See if their attendance drops or whatever. That would be unfortunate, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
My last thought on it was just a personal thing, feeling like, well, at first I should call out Amanda Bloom, who had a very good post, and I think we'll put in the show notes that it was the most reasonable one of all, which she starts out being like, listen, I don't like this chick, but I have other reasons for that I'm going to explain. So I'm more qualified than anybody here to kind of, like, give this a fair shake. And she says, despite all of that, you know, this is this is ridiculous and she shouldn't have been treated this way. So I think that one's a pretty good read. And I just want to say, as a person who goes to plenty of conferences, I'm more than capable of making an inappropriate joke sometimes. Whatever that makes me, you know, have whatever opinion you want about that, but please just turn around and tell me to STFU or call me out on it, you know, if that's making you uncomfortable or whatever. It makes me sad to know that, like, what I could go to a conference and say some little dumb joke, which I'm bound to do, and possibly have consequences this steep.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of wild. Okay. That one is very heavy. Here's the next one. Get ready.
Yeah.
So Dan Eden, friend of the podcast, he's an up-and-comer designer. I think he's on NetMag's, what would you call it, Best Young Designer or something. He's up for a nomination or there. Anyway, he wrote a post called UX is not a standalone job, basically calling into question the UX profession, which spawned a holy moly, not death threats, but a slew of comments like you are ignorant, blah, blah, blah. Just world of comments from people from the UX community. I thought this was a very interesting post. Mark Otto also from GitHub, he also had a post similar to that, like called Make Everything an Experience. He didn't assault UX professionals in that way, but he kind of like was just like, I think everyone should be in charge of UX, you know? But Chris, you got tangled up. You got ensnared a bit.
I did a little bit, but I was just protecting Dan because he's been a nice guy to me. And I do, and I refuse to take this back. I even called the guy a dick in a blog post, which I never, ever do. But I was mad, and I still am kind of, because it was ridiculous. Okay, so just as a little bit more framework for this post,
sure.
Dan says, I'm a designer. Of course, when I design, I'm thinking about the user experience. That's what a designer is. You think about what it's like to use this thing, and we design something that's better. Like, so what is the difference then between somebody who calls themselves or has the title of UX designer from somebody who is just a designer? And Dan just says, I'm having a bit of trouble wrapping my head around this. He uses sentences like that and kind of goes on and just says, and I've had this feeling myself, other people have had this. I may have even written about it before. I'm not even sure. And then somebody will come along and they'll just say, hey, you know, watch it a little bit. There are UX people who they, you know, you spend your day, you know, pushing pixels around and considering user experience, but, you know, using your kind of your instinct for it mostly and trying to make good choices. And then a UX designer will come along and be like, well, you spend your day in code and in Photoshop and stuff. I'm going to spend my day taking this design, taking it to the people, doing user research, applying known research about these kind of things, like looking at analytics data. We spend our days in different ways. That's okay that there's a different title for that. You know, and some people spoke up, but this one guy was just, we don't have to go into it a bunch, but he ripped Dan apart with really like rude words, I feel like. And there's 100 other ways you could have worded this comment that just said like, hey, you know, I'm studying this field and I kind of disagree with you a little bit than to just be like, you know, than to just jab at him 100 ways. And I just said like, okay, well, even if you disagree, whatever, you're a dick. Anyway, we worked it out on Twitter. We're not like enemies anymore, but
yeah, it was sort of like, you are an ignorant child. You're dumb. I don't know. Alex, your thoughts? You probably work with some UX people.
Yeah, it's actually a pretty common, you know, thread. Like, people go to our UX designers, or like, they're just our product designers, I guess is what they're called, right? And, like, there's a good chunk of them that have, like, zero design chops. Like, mm-hmm. they literally, like, they do analytics and they do like user research and they'll bring in people to the office and decide, you know, like here's this best way that these people flow this way and that way. Right. And, you know, we kind of have one core set of products that we put 500 people in front. So it's several people's full-time jobs to like decide how to stitch all that together and decide what features go in. And then there are, you know, visual designers who make it. I mean, they don't pick fonts and colors only. Like, I understand there is an inherent need to be a good UX designer whenever you are a designer without a UX designer, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I absolutely think that that there are separate roles. There is enough room in my company for someone who I greatly value to never like open Photoshop and is absolutely a designer, right? Like, mm-hmm. absolutely is designing the product. So I'm not disagreeing with Dan. I didn't actually read the post, but I do think that there are different jobs, and that, like, it just sometimes doesn't make sense to hire both people if you're working on a small enough thing, right? But mm-hmm. but at the level of like us trying to like increase Walmart's conversion rate,
mm-hmm.
It absolutely like takes a person or a group of people to like consider that over time without pixels being involved.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great way to put it. If I could hire 50 people at CodePen, yeah, right, not going to happen. But if I was tomorrow, certainly some of them would be UX specific, and that they could take this design that currently exists and think about it from a totally UX and kind of inform what the designers and developers really are going to work on next to make it a better product.
Yeah.
Mark Otto also chimed in on this same kind of thing, only there wasn't a comment thread on his.
Yes. Smart.
Smart. That's how you avoid drama. No comments.
Yeah. But he's just talking about like everyone should be providing a good user experience. Sort of. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I also agree with that. Francis Berryman, Faye on Twitter, gave a good talk last year at TXJS about how UX is everyone's responsibility. So if you have a UX person, that doesn't like absolve you of the responsibility of caring about users at all, right?
So, yeah.
That's something to, like, putting up good standard ways of doing things. You know, when we do this way, should be the way that we do that is a good way to get developers involved in good UX decisions by default, you know?
And that's sort of where I settled on it, was like a good designer, like, we want to just do what are good designers and bad designers, a good designer has a strong sense of UX. A good developer also has a strong sense of UX, I feel. I mean, and if you don't have, if your developers or whatever don't have that, they're completely apathetic. Like, I don't know, put them on like server modules, like coding out.
Most people can care too, though. I work with a guy named Tim on CodePen who has done no design or front end, really anything at all on the site. He's like server and back end and stuff, a little bit of JavaScript, but mostly back end. He cares deeply about what it's like to use CodePen and has lots of opinions about that.
Yeah, I find that like business driven development or you know, test driven development, a lot of times is driven off of like how you want the product to be, but it should really be like user driven development. Like there should be essentially, I go to my product designer, I say, how do you want this to work and feel? And then I work backwards from there in order to code it, right? So even if it's like, oh, nice, that's going to be hell to, you know, get that to load in that way, like that's just something I have to deal with. We don't make design decisions for the user based on like technical challenges.
Yes. You know. That's the best. Mm-hmm. That's the best. I love that. That's like how you, and you're a fan, I'm assume, of that approach.
Oh, that's awful. I hate it.
I think most organizations should have their like lead JavaScript dev making all the user research decisions.
I had an example this morning, just because I was thinking about CodePen. Even Dave, I was like, oh crap, it's podcast day. I got to get my... Because I was working on a UX thing. So we have drag and drop file upload in CodePen now, right? You just have this, like a file that you want to use when you're building something, but you know, you like don't want to deal with third-party hosting or whatever. You just need to link up this image file or whatever. You can just kind of drag it on CodePen and it'll upload it and use it. It had this dumb experience where you could like select some text even on the same page of it and like drag, you know, you can drag a sentence after you've copied it. Uh-huh. Like that triggers an HTML5 drag enter event also. just dragging text, which is super obnoxious. So we like it would like launch open the assets window when you did that and stuff. And I was like, crap. So I spent a bunch of time this morning trying to figure out if you can detect for, on an HTML5 drag enter event if there's a file attached or not, which there it turns out there is a way. It's a little weird, but and you know, anyway, I don't know what I guess I'm
you could
showing
also detect
off
that there was a range selected before you ever.
Oh, really?
Like fire the event, yeah.
Oh, that might be even better. So you don't have to like let the event fire and then detect.
It's a little more explicit. Yeah, I'd do that.
Yeah, but
ooh, laptop.
But can't some text be selected and then you like leave the page and go get a file and drag it in, and it would prevent that then possibly?
Potentially, text it.
I guess you'd have to detect if then the window is in focus or not or whatever.
All right.
User experience. That's the point. Okay. A little more drama, a little more.
This one should be real quick, but Randy, I think Lucky or Lukey or
L-U-E-C-K-E.
Luke, he wrote a post called "I'm Done with the Web,"
which Alex, is crazy for like a 13-year-old kid to say. just kidding, Randy. Always, we always give Randy crap for looking young. He's not 13.
So I assume you read this post, huh, Alex?
Yeah. Sometimes when I go to San Francisco, me and Randy get drunk.
He
is quite the jaded, I think, about his experience with Cappuccino, which is fair. Cappuccino and 280 North and all those guys were way ahead of the game. And he did come off a little bit cocky in the post about how ahead of the game they were, but they really were like pretty damn good ahead of the game. They were doing compile to JavaScript with Objective-J and Objective-C. I think there was a pretty steep learning curve, and they got into like file size I guess since Dave never got a chance to recap the article, I'll do it.
Yeah, please, please.
The article was pretty much, hey, I worked on this thing called Objective-J and Cappuccino, and it was really great, and this was 4 years ago, and then around that time, people started really caring about, micro.js and tiny file sizes. And if they couldn't learn the two functions in 30 minutes, then it wasn't worth their time. And it really was like anti-intellectualism. And we really can be doing better and stop repeating ourselves and using stupid things that don't work as well and blah, 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 blah.
I think he had a quote in there. He's like, one of the biggest concern is like, it's going to take me at least a day or two to learn this, like, yeah. Which is just, yeah, probably.
Hopefully. If it's doing anything of value. So, and his final sentiment was like, all right, so I'm going to work on Google now, and you good luck rebuilding everything. And he mentioned like Ember and some of these other things falling into the same trap as Cappuccino was 4 years ago, and how we're really just repeating ourselves, which is fair. I mean, Cappuccino
super
was
fair.
Huge. Sproutcore was huge. And they really would have like reduced performance a little bit. So I think there's probably somewhere in the middle, but like if Cappuccino would have caught on, I'm sure we would have brought it down in file size by now. I'm not saying significantly. I'm saying like,
Buildable,
yeah, all that kind of stuff. Like, I don't think that size concerns are completely unfounded because that's a huge part of user experience, But I do think that at the point, I think the Ember guys do a good job of like picking people who built backbone applications and finding out their file size, and then go finding like a similar Ember application. And Ember a lot of time is smaller because like you're doing less of writing that code yourself. So for some certain size app, you're going to reach the big sizes, even if you use a ton of tiny libraries. You're just going to write a lot worse code in order to fill in those gaps, rather than having, conventions to rely on each time. So I thought it was a good point. Though he said he's quitting the web and he's going to work on Google Now, but my guess is that Google Now works totally over HTTP.
It's just a job.
Yeah, that's funny. That was my favorite part. It's like, I'm done with the web. I'm going to go work at this web company.
I thought at the end, he's like, the quote I really loved was like, meanwhile, the web community will continue to solve the same NOM problems over and over again, which is pretty sweet burn. That's a sick burn.
Well, if you didn't put naan in there, it would sound better, you know, because we really do solve the same problems over and over and over and over. You can't.
Yeah.
Think of just HTML and CSS, like, too. How many times has somebody freaking how many times has somebody wrote the custom CSS for, like, a little custom drop-down menu or a little, you know, like, we write the same stuff. How many people have to write the same stuff over and over and over and over and over again? That's why I still have a positive opinion of things like Bootstrap, because people like to complain about it all the time, but it's like, at least it's like whoever used it kind of saved so much time. I kind of like this idea of, like, standardized components.
The idea behind everyone using the same thing, though, is completely unrealistic. I think that's one of the best things about the web, is that as soon as Bootstrap becomes popular, then it almost encourages people to do something cooler or better, because they don't want to look the same as everyone else, right?
Yeah.
And so I mean, Select2 and Chosen and all those are great drop downs. I think Select2 has a proposal to actually get into HTML proper.
Is it really?
At least not the specific library, but the exact,
but the idea of it. So people don't know, it's kind of like a select menu, but you, when you open it up, it has like a, like, you can type into a input box too. So if you had a list of all the US 50 states, you click it, you open it, you type WI, you're going to get Wisconsin there, and you can click it. It's just better than a select menu. It's just like better in all ways.
So it'd be easy to fall back to an old one there and all that kind of stuff. So I think, you know, the fact that people redid select menus, you know, in EXT and in jQuery UI and all these places like 100 times, and finally, like, we're like, all right, this pattern has shown up enough times in enough different places to where let's standardize this, and then someone will make a better one after that. So I think it's one of the most redeeming qualities of the web, is that we don't get stuck in, like the web of today doesn't look anything like the web of 4 years ago, but we're all still doing the same things, right? Mm-hmm. But it's more of an organic, like, move down the path of change than it is. Like, you know, 10 people are going to write script loaders at the same time, but now no one cares about script loaders, right? And same thing for select boxes.
Well, I think about, like, Bootstrap. Chris, that was a great example. It's like, I read a blog post today, like, stop using Bootstrap, it's ugly, or like, yeah, it's that same black bar. And it's like, okay, sure, that, I mean, you can aesthetically disagree with it, but, like, man, if I need to know, or like, if I'm looking for, like, a best practice or something on how to code a I don't know, a zebra striped table with 5 different themes, I'm gonna look at Bootstrap. Why not? It's fine. It works.
And you can use little bits of it if you want. Anyway.
Okay.
I got to do a sponsor here, and you're going to love it. Converge SE, ConvergeSE, Converge, and then SE, like Southeast. It's in Columbia, South Carolina, otherwise known as COLA. Little local knowledge for you there. I believe Famously Hot is also their slogan, right? That's COLA, right? Not Atlanta or something. Pretty sure it's COLA. Famously Hot. What are they, like the Gamecocks there? Anyway, it doesn't matter. Go to their website and go to their conference. It's super sweet. So these are the guys that do Unmatched Style, Gene and Jay and Geo. Other names. They should have like a Three Amigos thing too, although I heard that's kind of taken.
Yep. It's a thing right now.
Anyway, it's April 25th through 27th. So I'm going to be at it speaking. Daniel Burka from Google there. We talked about Google earlier in the show, so you understand what it is and does now. I'm looking forward to seeing Aaron Draplin again, because the last conference I was at, I missed his talk, and he sounds like a firecracker, and I can't wait to see him. Anyway, Converge SE, 25th through 27th, there's going to be like workshops and then days of talks and whatever. It's super affordable as these things go. You know, some conferences get pretty pricey, but I think this is well priced. So there isn't even a discount code, because you don't need one, people.
Yeah.
Anyway, what else do we have to say?
Oh, I was going to say, Draplin was awesome. It's a rock show. It's a multimedia presentation. It is so good. So it's worth going just for that. But everyone there on that roster is really awesome. So
Jen Lucas, and then a huge amount of people that I'm looking forward to meeting there.
Cool.
Sass dude. Okay.
Last bit of hot drama. Are you guys ready, or do you want to move into some questions? We can save this hot drama.
I mean, I think there's some good hot drama that you're missing. I want to know if I know the last one.
The last one is Chrome OS ships with HTML5 encrypted media extensions API.
Guessed it.
Basically, DRM is now baked into Chrome OS.
You gotta spell this out for me. I'm a little slow. What is it? I don't even understand. I really don't.
Alex, you're good at this, huh?
I do some of this for a living, yeah.
Okay. DRMS.
So it's not DRM, guys. It's encrypted media extensions.
Totally different.
Totally different. I don't know. So pretty much encrypted media extensions allows people to more or less add their own DRM.
Okay.
Bring your own DRM, if you will. So like Netflix uses encrypted media extensions in order to do, you can't download our videos on Netflix type stuff. Right.
So that happens over Silverlight now or something.
Well, they have HTML5 videos as well.
Oh, okay.
So it's not, it isn't DRM, but it enables your own DRM. I don't know. It's the Widevine content decryption module.
Widevine, Google company.
Yeah.
Is now.
Is that the drama part somehow?
Well, I don't. The drama part to me is it like all the Google employees, Hixie, Paul, all these people are like, I'm just kidding about Paul. But like,
I don't think he's commented on it.
Yeah, their mum's the word. Or like Hixie posted this thing like, oh, DRM is not that bad. It works for DVDs. He posted it on Google Plus, of course, because they all post there. But like, it works for DVDs. But and he's like, you know, if you didn't have DRM, then you'd be able to watch a video on your phone and take that to your TV. And it's like, yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, let's do that. No,
that sounds awesome. The future you're describing, Hixie, is actually terrible to me. But like, and then everyone else from Google is just quiet as a mouse, you know, like, but it's just like, whatever. A DRM company owned by Google is now baked into Google so that they can DRM company. I just think it's going to lead to this future where like watch this video, but only on Google Chrome browser.
Oh, that's the drama. Okay. I was waiting for the reveal. I'm like, I still don't understand why I should care, but specifically
Chrome OS.
Chrome OS. Yeah.
So I don't think it's in Chrome proper if I'm reading this right. Yeah, Chrome OS dev channel.
That's almost even more annoying, though. So if there's like if I shoot a video and I really want to protect it, I could run a little detection or whatever and be like, if you don't have Chrome OS on
your
phone,
then you run Flash.
Oh, then there is a fallback deal.
Well, Flash, you can already do DRM, right?
Yeah.
DRM is on the web, and people will continue to use that. The problem here is that companies won't ever move to HTML5 video if we don't do DRM, right? Or, you know, supposedly. And that's held very, very true. And so we're accidentally holding the web back by saying, you know, you can't have DRM, which is why, you know, like even Tim Berners-Lee was like, yeah, DRM could be okay. and you know, it's obviously not okay. It's not going to do anything good. It really needs to be like, we just wait till those guys die. And then,
the old wait till they die approach.
But yeah, so there's this actually a spec for the encrypted media spec, w3.org/tr/encrypted-media. But yeah, so specifically the wording they use is this specification does not define a content protection or digital rights management system. Rather, it defines a common API that may be used to discover, select, and interact with such systems, as well as simpler content encryption systems. So really, it's like bring your own DRM, more or less.
And you're like, this is the worst. And Hixie's like, this is the best. So that's...
Well, they're just... They want a DRM in because it is good for business. And this is a way to bring DRM in without bringing DRM in.
Ah. Interesting. Yeah, that's worth...
I guessed it, but that was what I was.
That's what you're thinking. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. The future that Hixey proposed in his apologetic about DRM, it's not so bad, bud. It's like, I hate that. I don't want to live in that.
I read the post. It was interesting in that, and then he makes points about how effective it has been in certain ways. About how, you know, I know that the one you described sucks, but like, for example, you can't buy a DVD player that it has baked into it some ability to skip stupid intro movies.
Right.
You just can't, because if you want to sell a DVD player, you got to license the stuff. You got to agree to not do that.
So the future of DRM, based on that, is, hey, BTW, I'll make you pay for this and watch more ads and bullcrap. Like, I don't know. I'm frustrated by all that. I guess I'm only frustrated until somebody pays me. So there you go.
Well, you're frustrated by that, but you probably use Hulu and Netflix and you already get that stuff.
I do, actually.
It's over Silverlight or Flash, right? So it's not stopping that from happening. It's just keeping Silverlight and Flash alive and stopping people from using HTML5 video.
I guess so. Yeah, I guess that's the only difference, is I am experiencing that just with a plugin. So,
right. So this is just a new plugin.
All right. But should we be relying on plugins? Because, isn't it going to be like your browser doesn't support the Wavevine, Wirevine plugin?
Well, no, specifically the encrypted media extensions is something that is a spec, and then I think you just attach your DRM to that, pretty much.
Okay, so, all right. Grumble.
I was reminded of this. Jason Scott is doing text files on Twitter. He like works for the archive.org and stuff. I was just talking to him the other day, and they have notes at archive.org that is like, when this guy dies, make this content available. They have like internal notes. So literally they do just kind of like wait for the person who cares about the copyright to die.
That's beautiful. All right.
I got to do a news and links. Check this out. Let's do a sponsor real quick so I can get my thoughts together on what I was going to say. Longtime sponsor, Environments for Humans, which you can go check out all the stuff they do at environmentsforhumans.com. But more specifically, April 16th through 18th. So this is a little bit before Converge. It's an online conference. So no matter where you live in the world, you don't have to buy a ticket. You don't have to get a plane ticket. You don't have to buy a hotel room, whatever. You can attend this online, thanks to DRM. and just watch it. So you watch the speaker, you know, gives notes, and there's actually quite a lot of back and forth real time, because there's a chat room, which a lot of conferences don't have, like an official chat room, right? You like use your mouth or whatever, which is, you know, it's a little analog. There's like an official chat room. So you watch the speaker in one window and there's chat in another window. And it's 3 days all about responsive web design. So you can check it out at rwdsummit.com. 3 full days of speakers, and it's priced accordingly. It's less expensive. So it's another one of those things that you guys can afford to go if you're interested in RWD and all it has to offer. So thanks for sponsoring that. Even if you work at a company and you want everybody in your whole company to like have access to it, you can buy a ticket for that too, which I think is pretty cool. And if I worked at a big company, I would push for, because it would just be an effective use of money. You want to send people to conferences, but you don't want to buy like 10 plane tickets. Do this instead.
Yeah.
I was going to mention the newsletter webdesignweekly.com. There's dashes between either one of those words, web-design-weekly. They're not paying for a sponsorship or whatever. He tried to. And I was like, dude, we'll just mention it on the show. It's cool. You do great work with sending out fresh links every single week about web design. And I'm just on the website now. This is Jake Breshenen, by the way. He's on number 81. So he's been doing this for a long time, and it's totally worth subscribing to. You know, I think he started with the JavaScript ones. There was like a really good weekly JavaScript email newsletter that everybody got into. And then people are like, I'm going to copy that. I'm going to start doing this. I'm glad Jake did, because he does a good job with it. So web-design-weekly.com is totally worth subscribing to.
All right. Let's get into a question. We got time for a couple here. So this one's from Sam Loveland. Right for Alex. I've got a question for Alex. I'm leveling up in JavaScript and I'm stuck at this learning cliff of event handlers. I've been scouring the internet and the intermediate Mozilla docs are almost boring with the basics right up until it gets on this subject. What is it about event handlers in this part of JavaScript that makes it such a huge hurdle? I was a writer before becoming a web developer, so if you could come up with a prompt or use case that might help me and others delve into this problem and come to a solution, that would be great.
Sam Loveland just doesn't understand event handlers. Maybe Alex, could you just like help Sam understand what that is?
Yeah, so you need to understand a few things, the bubble phase and the capture phase, and then you need to understand the old IE model just for a second so you know not to use it. And then you've been reading MDN, which is the good stuff. You might read a little bit about how John Resig won the attach event programming PPK contest like way back in the day and read that code. And then my solution to your event handling problem is to write an event handler system. So there's add event listener and try to essentially create jQuery on. You want to do event delegation and like direct event attachment. And then once you're done writing that, you'll be completely clear on how that works. And feel free to open source it. But don't suggest people use it unless it's well tested or whatever. But seriously, my suggestion to anyone who wants to learn anything.
Alex was
kind of
kidding there. Just for
no.
seconds.
No, I'm serious. Go implement an event handler system. It's not hard. I mean, it's not that crazy. That's the thing is like there are event bubbling and you know bubble and capture phase that's kind of weird and you need to like understand how it goes up and then back down. But really, like after that, it's just like listen for something to happen and then you have a callback to it, right? And so it's actually you can check out like the event handling systems in like either Zepto or Ender if you want like a really simple like way of either pared down from like jQuery or whatever, and then just try to mimic them, right? Like create, like I swear it's the first day will be really frustrating, but if you implement your own, you will understand it forever and ever and ever. That's how I did it, I promise.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, that's a good point. I mean, Sam, if you absolutely don't even understand what it is, I mean, that's kind of a different, you know, I'm not sure launching into trying to write your own event handler system is going to help. But sure. Maybe he's further than
seems
that.
Seems like
explain.
He's in the MDN documentation and is bored by it. Then it seems like you're at a point where it's like, I don't understand like the nuance of it, but I do understand like the general idea of listen for an event and respond to it.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's the big thing is like, You just say like listen for a click and then do something when this thing is clicked. For instance, clicks right. is just a good example, or hover or something. But enter.
The thing that will be interesting when you do that is like when you listen on document for things that happen on other elements, and then you look into the event and it'll give you codes and you know original targets and all that kind of stuff. And then it's good to like go and see what jQuery gives you on top of that, because that's one of the nice things about jQuery is it can normalize that event object to where you can expect things back from it.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is one of the more interesting things about events, right? You like the first day you learn about it, you're like, oh, I see. I watch for a click, and then I do something after the click happens, uh-huh. and not just a click. How many events are there? There's not even that many, right? It's like it's kind of like CSS selectors and stuff. You're kind of surprised at how not very many of them there are. I bet there's 20 or something, or am I way off?
They're infinite.
Well, right, because you can just declare arbitrary ones. So how many DOM-specific call ones are there?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably not too many. More than you'd expect. On touch start, on touch drag, on drag start, on all that kind of stuff. You know?
Yeah. Cool. So, then how it bubbles up, right? So if you have an anchor link, well, that same exact event is going to be triggered on the div that's contained within it or whatever, assuming that you haven't canceled that bubblation. That's what they call it, right?
Yep.
I think that's a good start. Do we have time for one more question? Is that?
Yeah, I think so.
Event handlers are interesting to me. I'm interested in this next question, though. Did we cover it? I don't know. Did I cut it off too soon?
No.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, good. All right. So Gabe Luthi wrote in and said, I feel like it has been an accepted best practice to load Google's jQuery because it's more likely to be cached by a visitor's browser and whatever local version you have on a website. But I recently saw this Twitter conversation linked to Alex Sexton status 313824444 with a reply by Alex, which seems to suggest that there's a little real world, that there is little real world benefit to this case. And it sounded like this was because there are so many versions of jQuery out there, and the likelihood of a visitor actually having that version of on their site is linking to in their browser cache is really low. I'd like to hear more about this.
Yeah, at jQuery.to, I mentioned that in my talk because I was talking about require.js and builds and stuff like that. And then that person who asked me after the conference, is it really better to build jQuery? He posted it to the HTML5 boilerplate where we include the jQuery, or we where they include the jQuery CDN version of jQuery. Mm-hmm. And that's more or less because it's a situation where there's no build system for HTML5. Yeah. So in boilerplate, there is an issue created essentially around should we encourage people to build or should we keep this Google CDN thing in there? And it may be the best case scenario to keep Google in HTML5 boilerplate because there is no build system. But the chance that someone has hit a site in the top, you know, whatever sites that uses a Google CDN is at best case if you're using 1.4 to 1.7%, right? So that's like best case scenario. And that's if you like never clear your cache. And so like, people are like, oh, well, so there's a pretty good chance that some people might hit this single version of jQuery. And Steve Souders, you know, looked into some of the data. And surprisingly, the guy who works for Google is like, oh, I know, maybe it's still a good idea to use a Google CDN. I don't necessarily agree. I think if you're going for, hey, maybe I can save some bandwidth or I don't have a very good, you know, server or something like that, sure, whatever. But like, if you're doing things right, you can deploy jQuery as part of your own package and put it in a single request and cache that until the next time you update your files, which isn't as much as they like to make it seem. It's about as much as jQuery updates, you know, in reality. So in practice, in tested sites across the internet that I have access to over and over and over and over again, the fastest average way to load jQuery and decide is to build it into a single file and load it asynchronously at the top of the page every time. And that's the fastest average. That's not saying that there are a subgroup of people who would have had a faster experience if you, the first page load would have had a faster experience, the first page load, if you would have used the Google CDN. But it is not a high enough number to actually end up making a difference.
Interesting.
So that's fair. So the takeaway from the chat is not to host locally. It's to build your files and then upload it to CloudFront. And so you're still distributed globally, all that kind of stuff, but it's a single request to a single domain. So you don't have an extra DNS cache lookup. You don't have extra HTTP handshakes. It's just load it all. The only downside of that is if it's big enough, then that kind of sucks on mobile. So you can start doing some of the stuff with like loading JavaScript into strings and then evaling it later, or loading it into comments and Ajaxing it in. I'm going to write a post on this. I'm in the middle of it. But the idea is load everything that you need to start your site in one file right away. Yeah. And then nothing else.
Not just jQuery either. That's the thing. Like, just loading jQuery as one request is a little weird these days almost, because the chances of you only needing jQuery is super low, right?
I mean, well, it's zero. You don't use it.
Right. It doesn't do anything for you.
So my suggestion is figure out a way with your build system, and I use AMD, so it's much easier for me than someone who manages their own dependencies, but figure out a way to only load So a specific example is at work, we have a submission form, write a review. And that submission form only pops up if you click write a review. And so you know, how many people do you think actually write reviews on e-commerce sites? You know, less than 1% probably, and that's good. That's a good thing, right? So there's no reason we should load any code that is only used, you know, templates or handlers or, you know, cross-domain communication or any of that stuff that's only used in that submission form at page load. So we don't. We build all that out. And then when you get, like, within, you know, 500 pixels of the write a review button, we'll preload it for you. Or if you've been idle for a few seconds, we'll preload it for you. And that way it's a cache hit whenever you actually do need it. And it, you know, it runs about as quickly as possible. But yeah, there are much, 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 much better ways to optimize your site load than, you know, relying on the Google CDN. But, like, it is a good, lazy way of getting some performance. It's better than not doing anything. It's better than loading 26 scripts with Yepnope.
Right. So the conversation, I don't know, it's just one of those. It's one of those arguments that's like there's more important things you can do than argue over this. Like in the CSS world, it's like about selectors or whatever. Like, you should use more ID selectors because those are faster. And people are like, oh, come on, dude.
I think Paul Irish apologized for his jQuery 2010 talk on anti-patterns for performance, where he talked about selector speed a lot, because it's really just not an issue. It's like, if you go into Google Tools and you look at the total time spent doing anything, selectors are, you know, less than 0.5% on the entire site.
And that's Google, and it might be different from browser to browser, but it's still, like, from the day I first started making websites ever, like, it's just never mattered. It's never been one of those things that in the recent thing that fired it up was this post, and I'm very sorry that I remember the guy's name. He was a smart guy, works at GitHub, and he was optimizing a particular page on GitHub that was so crazy. It had, you know, like 100,000 DOM nodes on it or whatever, and previously had some pretty gnarly selectors on it. So it was kind of like, and even then the performance benefits for it were like okay, but not amazing.
That was Kyle Neath.
Kyle Neath, yeah.
Yeah. I guess the last part someone mentioned in the chat, there's, I think it might be an actual website, but the One Less JPEG like initiative I really like. Yeah, it's like, people are like optimizing the hell out of, like, you know, 3K of JavaScript, and, you know, like, Zepto's great, but, like, seriously, it's just jQuery minus cross browser support. It's like,
you're gonna want that IE8. Tell you what.
Yeah. So things like that are silly. Whenever, like, you're like, well, I'm using Zepto because I want to be fast, and then you include, you know, full screen background images with, you know, Gaussian blurred applied to them as a separate request, and completely nullify anything that you did with the Zepto. But now at least you don't work on the whole web.
Yeah.
Okay, that's good. We got two questions in, the two Alex specific ones. Thanks everybody for doing that. We actually had one question this week that was a good audio one, only it was like 2.5 minutes long. Just as a heads up, we love the audio questions, so if you could keep them brief-ish, that would be sweet.
Makes good radio. I was going to say, internet, if you could stop doing so much hot drama, we could get to some darn questions. You guys need to chill out, all of you, please.
Just because I can predict the future, me and Dave have already recorded a rapid fire though that you're gonna like, that has tons of Q&A in it, really. Fast.
Pew, pew, pew. Anyhow, so I guess we should wrap up. We're going over time, and Alex is a busy man, gets paid the big bucks. So Alex, if people aren't already, how can they follow you, get in touch with you, tweet you, buy your stuff? How does that work?
I'm Slex Axton most places, SlexAxton. And that would do. That's GitHub and Twitter.
Yeah.
Tweet me your jokes or something. I don't know.
What GitHub repo of yours should people mess with right this very minute?
I'm a co-contributor to Lettering.js, some
crap
library.
Span injector.
The guy
makes your site totally inaccessible. True story. All right.
Is there accessibility problems with that?
Screen readers read spans by pausing. It's Yes. Oh, awful.
Isn't there an Aria attribute that's going to be like Aria continuous true or something? There should
that be. That would be awesome, but
all the screen readers would definitely follow it, because that's that's definitely how screen readers work, right?
They tend to be on the cutting edge of support. I have a workaround possibly in my brain. I just need to do it. So, support. All right. Well, cool. Awesome. Thanks, Alex, so much for coming on the show. Thanks, everyone, for coming out into the chat room. You guys are wonderful, wonderful people. You keep us honest. You give us facts. Thank you guys for subscribing in iTunes and rating us a 5, of course. And thank you for following us at Shop Talk Show on Twitter. Buy a t-shirt. Do all that stuff. And Chris, you got anything else to add?
ShopTalkShow.com.